Community is United for Action, Power, and Justice, which focuses on criminal justice reform in Georgia. He starts us off by helping us understand the term prison industrial complex.
So we start out by asking, what's the role of a prison? What does a prison do? You know, listeners right now could kind of think about that for a second. What does a prison do? You know, it dehumanizes people. It attacks people. It creates hopelessness. It creates a violence. And in effect, when you add all that together, it removes people from society. And then you think about it, well, are there other institutions that remove people from society? Thinking about it in that context, we're not just talking about safety or security. We're talking about social control. Removing folks from society or creating a sense of violence or hopelessness within a community or attacking an entire community, shifting political power from one community to another, isn't about security or safety, at least for the majority of people and stuff. It's about controlling a population, social control. But a prison is a very specific institution. And for the most part, they're public institutions. In prison industrial complex, we have the word prison in there, but there's got to be other public institutions of social control in our communities. Let's name them. And folks can talk about the hospitals, the schools, the social service agencies, the public transportation system, on and on and on, all these public institutions of social control. So, okay, well, let's talk about the word industrial. Are they private institutions of social control? What are those in the community? Well, there are banks, there's the media, there's probably private hospitals, they're the financiers. Somebody had to build the prison or the hospital and stuff, so you have the construction companies. You have these private institutional social control and public institutional social control. So we're left with this word complex. What does complex mean? And complex has many different definitions. In this context, I think the best one to use is the psychological definition, that a complex is the overreaction to a perceived fear. So prison industrial complex is prisons, those public institutions of social control, not just prisons, not specifically prisons, but public institutions of social control, partnering with private institutions of social control in the overreaction to a perceived fear. So we have to go a little bit further here. What's the perceived fear? And we could say crime. We have to look into U.S. history on what does crime really mean. And crime has a very specific meaning. It means people of color, specifically but not exclusively black people. And that's based on the history of the United States.
De Garcia goes on to explain how the history of chattel slavery was created to control peoples in the United States.
One of the first institutions of social control. What is the first institution you can think of used to control a population? Chattel slavery. Now, this is different than other institutions used to eliminate a population. If you want to eliminate a population, what you're trying to do is get rid of them as much as possible. But what you need to do is control a population so they're around and can be exploited. You have to make sure that you have power over them, that they're around to exploit. So chattel slavery is one of the first institutions of social control in the U.S. context. So from them, what was chattel slavery about? It was making sure you had a relevant population. Those populations were black, in the U.S. context, African Americans. And this is very particular, because if you think about, you know, the history of land in the U.S., in order to get land, the institutions had to remove the people. How did the United States treat Native Americans as opposed to Africans? Well, they had to get the land that the people lived on. The Native Americans lived on. So even to this day, when you think of what people have to go through to prove to the federal government that they're Native Americans, from the very beginning, this country had the one-drop rule. It was easy to be black in this country because they needed a ready population that could be economically exploited. With Native Americans, they needed the population removed so they could take the land. It's from these experiences that today's systems and institutions of social control exist. So particularly we're talking about these institutions of chattel slavery used to control a population, not necessarily exterminate them, but to remove them from society.
While today, chattel slavery of African Americans does not exist as an institution in the United States, Dan Horowitz de Garcia of Communities United for Action, Power, and Justice explains how the form and force of chattel slavery continue to influence U.S. institutions of today.
From this, I think there's a real piece we want to talk about of form versus nature. There's that popular song now, or was, George Bush don't like black people.
Uh-huh.
And you know, there's that line in that song that said, all we've been through and nothing's changed. Mm-hmm. And I totally understand the sentiment, you know, of all the struggle and all the sacrifice people have made and they're still suffering. I also recognize, though, that, I mean, things are different. Today, there's no chattel slavery in the United States. That was a victory that popular movements in this country won. But that doesn't mean that the system of social control has ended. And I think the difference, a subtle difference here, is that the form has changed. Chattel slavery does not exist. That form has changed. But its basic nature still exists. That nature of dehumanization, of hopelessness, of extreme violence, that nature and systems, that's still the nature of social control in the United States. And I think in popular songs about nothing's changed, that's what particularly people are talking about. And that's a reality we have to acknowledge. Now, why does the form change? Well, the form changes based on what the economy needs at the time. But its basic nature, when chattel slavery turned into convict leasing, it was still extremely violent and dehumanizing and bred a sense of hopelessness. That's what it was based on. When we talk about immigration policies, segregation, or talk about social control in any context within the United States on any community, particularly on communities of color, the nature of it is still the same nature as with chattel slavery. But the form changes based on the needs of the economy at the time. So the last piece about this is like, okay, so what's the economy of today? And I think the big question going on right now is what's the economy of the world going to look like for the next 100 years? And the elite have their plan. You know, they call it corporate globalization, or particularly neoliberalism. And what neoliberalism is changing the very definition of what is a government, what's it supposed to do, what's its role in society. Neoliberalism is completely changing that. Neoliberalism is the philosophy behind globalization. So what it means is the role of government is to get out of the way. The free market, the so-called free market, is all that's really necessary in order to have society run. So it's the values of that. It's privatization, extreme deregulation, and it's the end of any kind of social contract with people. Poverty is just not a problem anymore. Not that poverty has gone away. Government's not in the business of ending or dealing with poverty. In order to justify that, neoliberalism says, well, it's your fault. So because that's changing, the forms of social control are changing. So in the last 20 years, we saw a complete explosion of prison population, because in the last 20, 30 years, we've seen an explosion of neoliberalism. As the needs of the economy change, so do the systems of social control. So we've seen immigration being tied closer and closer to criminal justice. Police now are immigration agents. We've seen IDs and racial profiling become the norm. It's not like all this stuff didn't exist, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. But in the last 20 years, it's really expanded. It's become more of the norm, and it's reached into many different populations because the needs of the economy have dictated that's what's necessary.
You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. Before we move on to the next guest, organizer Dan Horowitz de Garcia explains what the Georgia-based Communities United for Action, Power, and Justice does.
We're a new criminal justice coalition in the state, and we've come together on the idea that bringing together those most affected by the criminal justice system with those who are doing other struggles around economic justice to build power, and to use that power to create a system that actually keeps our community safe and secure. So kind of breaking that down a little bit, we define those most affected by the criminal justice system as crime survivors, currently incarcerated people, formerly incarcerated people, and family members. The link here is, you know, those who are directly impacted by these different, by the criminal justice system, as well as those who are directly impacted by poverty. I mean, all these are the same groups of people, really. So you have one person that can fit all of these categories easily. But being very explicit about who we're trying to bring and who we're trying to lead this struggle, not to fix the criminal justice system, because we think it's working the way it's supposed to work. It's supposed to destroy our communities. But to challenge the idea of a criminal justice system as it works now, to really talk about safety and security for our communities in a holistic way.
13 million people in the United States were formerly incarcerated. That figure is 6.5% of the adult population. Discrimination in our communities against people who are in prison often dissuades people from becoming productive when returning to the community. Employment, housing, healthcare, education become unforgiving obstacles for one with a prison record. Our next guest is the executive director and founder of Reentry Solutions in Oakland, California. Mark Toney and Reentry Solutions promotes the reintegration of formerly incarcerated peoples in three ways: leadership development in communities, the buildup of the capacity of community organizations, like helping with fundraising and internal structure development, and finally, organizing campaigns, which focus on the fundamental needs for concrete change in one's community. Mark Tony begins by sharing some of the campaigns organizations are doing for incarcerated peoples.
For instance, the Ex-Offenders Action Network in Los Angeles, which was formed by the L.A. Metropolitan Churches. They've had a couple of campaigns. One is where they got the telephone company, MCI, to reduce the exorbitant rates they were charging people in prison. They were really able to bring those down so that people in prison could have more contact with their families. The other thing they were able to do is organize several hundred people to come to a series of rallies and speak outs to win $70 million of federal money, money that was allocated after the LA uprisings in 92 that was never spent and was going to be returned back to the federal government. These groups found out and got the support of Maxine Waters to allocate the money to a comprehensive reentry program that looks at housing, job counseling, job training, and a real support service in Los Angeles for people coming out of prison. That was a big victory because it was won by grassroots organizing. To me, that is where we're going to find the ability to move forward, is in the grassroots formations of people struggling, of people organizing, of people fighting for not just their civil rights, not just rights in a legal framework, but human rights. The rights that a lot of people are looking at this in a much more larger human rights frame, that there are rights that people have whether they're in the law or not. And that's what a lot of the international human rights work is about, is defining the right to cultural expression, a whole set of political rights, but also economic rights, that people have the right to eat, that people have a right to support themselves, that people have a right to housing. These are not legal rights guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution, but these are the rights of what it means to be a human being. I think we find a lot more of that happening at the grassroots level, and people who've been to prison who really have the most tremendous odds against them are some of the people that I think have the ability to envision a kind of society that is fair and just in ways that I think are very promising.
Mark Tony begins to construct his vision for truly changing prisons. It doesn't simply involve prison reform, but a restructuring of people's needs in society.
It's interesting who is in prison and who is not. Because on one hand, there are a lot of people who are doing terribly destructive things to the environment, to women, to people of color, to children, and are profiting just tremendously from it, and who aren't in prison. So part of what needs to happen is reorganizing what the point of prisons are and really looking at a society that provides people with basic opportunity, a society that is not so materialistic, but in fact offers people the ability to have jobs that not only pay bills, but feeds the soul. That the point of life is not simply to get more than the next person, but be able to spend time with family, to spend time being creative, to spend time enjoying the company of other people. And in order for that to happen, people have to have enough food to eat, a place to live. One of the things about prisons and about the need for prisons has to do with people for whom there is no place, other place in society for. If we were to reorganize how society is built and really look at production that serves what people's needs are, that looks at, let me give you a quick example. The folks, Science for the People movement, I think is one of the most inspirational movements in the world. They're based in Kerala, India. And they have two basic goals: reduce consumption and production while increasing the quality of life. And I think that those are our principles. Those are the kinds of principles that I think will lead to more justice, because we can't get there by simply producing more and consuming more material goods. The happiness doesn't come from the consumption of things. It really does come from people being able to live full lives. To me, that is what people who are organizing, people who are formerly incarcerated and their allies are demanding, that everybody, regardless of their status, has the right to live a full and fulfilling life. That's the vision.
This is People's Tribune Radio. Our next guest is the executive director of the community organization Direct Action for Rights and Equality, or DARE. DARE does grassroots organizing, leadership development, and political education of low-income families and communities of color to win economic, social, and political justice in Providence, Rhode Island. Sarah Mersha spoke with correspondent Tony Zaragoza about the work Direct Action for Rights and Equality is doing.
And what are some of the issues that you all are working on and some of the solutions that you're coming up with?
Mm-hmm. Right now we have four major campaigns that we're working on, and we see them as very much connected. So we have a campaign around schools that's trying to fight for better education for students in our city. We have a campaign around jobs that's trying to fight for community access to good jobs, and particularly for folks who have a prison record. We have a campaign around police accountability, where we fought for a civilian review board with some teeth in Providence and won that, and a campaign around prisons, which is working both on trying to change conditions within the prison, such as human rights abuses, as well as trying to prevent people from our communities from going to prison in the first place.
Talk to our listeners about the connections that you're seeing between your campaigns, mm-hmm. the police mm-hmm. accountability, the mm-hmm. mandatory minimums, and the others, and what we're seeing outside, well, inside the larger economy.
First, the connection between them, and we can look at the stories of a number of our members, right, who didn't get a good education in school, and that's on purpose, right? The society is set up so that our kids don't get a good education, so that they end up having the only option of going into jobs that are not going to give them a very good opportunity. So police end up picking them up more often, right, because of white supremacy and because of capitalism and the way that our communities are targeted. They end up in jail, get out of jail, can't get a job because they have a record, and it just being a continuous cycle. So that's something that we've seen in the lives of a number of our members. And there's a number of other issues that I think you could connect to it, and we're starting to look more at things such as the way that our communities' land are being taken away, so the gentrification, which a lot of folks talk about as another kind of colonization of our communities, but that's another way that the rich are really trying to control our communities and take them away from us. So, you know, just in the way people live their lives, there's no one issue that is separate from the others. You know, I think the way that folks are kept poor, they also need to be controlled. Mm. And we're talking today about that way that prisons and police are part of an overall system of social control. So we need to keep people down so that we don't rise up and topple the whole system of capitalism and imperialism. You know, I think we very much see this as something that is a part of keeping people down, as a part of protecting property for the rich. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it definitely opens it up to some of the things that we see happening, because then you also have a controlled labor force.
That's right.
With the threat of prisons.
That's right.
Constantly there, but
That's
also
right.
a captured labor force with, you know,
right.
industries in prisons.
That's right. And then that pits folks against each other in terms of work, right? So there's the work that folks are doing inside, and they get outside and they have a hard time getting a job even though they have skills. And then you've got unemployed folks pitted against folks who aren't really in a great situation but have a job, and that keeps overall wages down because they can say, well, we can always go hire these other folks, whether they are folks with a record or whether they're folks who are immigrants without papers, or right, but that's all part of how they try to maintain the system.
Well, could you also talk about what is it that we're fighting for?
Right.
What is it that we
yeah.
want to see?
Yeah.
And what is a more just way of dealing with problems in our community? I mean, those are three separate questions,
mm-hmm.
but I think they're
mm-hmm.
probably intertwined.
Yeah, so in terms of what we're fighting for, I mean, we're trying to define that right now. But I think in terms of a vision where, you know, people have what they need to live, right? So they have the ability to, you know, have enough income and resources for themselves, for their families. They're able to develop as human beings, right? Whether that means like learning something that you want to learn or being able to develop a skill that then benefits your community. So we're trying to figure out, well, how do we like connect those big theoretical ideas to campaigns on the ground? There's a concept that we've been talking about called justice reinvestment, which means that instead of investing so many dollars into criminalizing, incarcerating people, that if you take those same dollars and spend them on things that are actually going to benefit the community, then you will address the root causes and create a situation where there's less crime, right? Because people have opportunities through jobs, through education, through housing, or they have drug treatment if they need it. You know, not only is it less crime, but it's also stronger communities. So we're trying to figure out a way to implement that on a state level. And there's some challenges. In Rhode Island, there's actually real clear practice that they don't want to link. For example, if there's one bill that says that we are eliminating mandatory minimums and therefore will have a smaller prison population, they don't like that money to be tied to another specific program. So even though we could say, well, we have this money freed up now, let's use it for the people, it's a challenge in terms of making that connection. We're trying to figure those out right now.
What are some of the ways in which the programs that you do, you enact, and what are, on a day-to-day level, what does it look like?
On a day-to-day level.
Week-to-week, month-to-month, however.
Okay, so, you know, it has to be a lot of just getting out, talking to people who are affected by these issues. In terms of prisons, we recruit people by going to the prisons during visiting hours or during intake, talking to family members. Folks inside the prisons recruit each other by saying, oh, did you know about DARE? They write us letters and they connect. I'd say sometimes we're able to do some effective inside-outside work, but there's a lot of barriers to that. Sometimes when they've organized like a hunger strike inside and we try to like have publicity on it on the outside, things like that. But a lot of times too, it's like, you know, really just trying to do a lot of popular political education. So besides ourselves, who know what the impact of the prison system is, you know, we got to get our communities together to think about what are real solutions to this. But even beyond our communities, the low-income, oppressed nationality communities, we got to get beyond that to the bigger population in Rhode Island. So we've been trying to do these workshops at sometimes community centers, churches, things like that, to just like get folks thinking in a different kind of way. Sometimes it involves, you know, with mandatory minimums and trying to change that, that's changing a bill. So we have to be up at the State House, which is a headache because those folks are just like, that's not us, you know, and that's not our game. And so then on some level, you know, we're trying to figure out, well, what do we have control to create on our own? And I think that those are questions that we haven't figured out yet, but we're starting to try to move in that direction in terms of, yeah, we need to keep on putting pressure on the system, but also we need to support things from the ground up that don't rely on the system to do something or to not do it. Because that's another thing that we've learned is we've won a few things, such as the Civilian Review Board, such as implementation of this first source hiring thing, that they're not supposed to discriminate against people based on having a prison record. But in terms of that actually happening, it's still within the bureaucracy, and so that's, you know, a struggle to get our wins even put in place.
Any final words for our listeners who might want to know more about how you're doing your work and what it means? Even what are some of the obstacles that you face, and how, besides the mindset, but also how you get around them?
Mm-hmm. You know, obstacles of just dealing with institutions such as legislators and things like that. I think that's, it's necessary to make certain changes. I think we're trying to figure out how to not get caught into the tactics that have traditionally been used to target legislators, you know, kind of regular lobbying and testifying at their public hearings. Like, if we're going to win, we're going to have to win on our terms. It's not going to be on their terms. And so we need to figure out a way to maintain some militancy, even if we have to play on some of their turfs. We have to get to a scale and depth to be able to do that, right? So I think that, you know, there's some really exciting examples of folks who get to a different scale, particularly in the third world, where, you know, there's just engaging thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, and really to make the kinds of changes we need to make, we need to do that. And to do that, we need to be on the doors and talking to people, you know, in the street and talking to people where they go to school and in prison, all those different places. But I think one thing that sometimes movements in the United States have done is sacrifice the depth that you also need. So I think it's really important that we don't just count numbers, but we also make sure that as we're trying to get to the numbers that we need, that we take serious time to analyze the conditions that we're in and really think about what are the real solutions, because we do end up sometimes, if we don't do that, creating changes that end up hurting us in the end. So, you know, I think we have a lot of lessons to learn still, but that's one thing that I hope that we'll get better at.
And that is it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. Every month, PT Radio, in association with the newspaper People's Tribune, the bilingual magazine Tribuno del Pueblo, and Speakers for a New America, attempt to share with you information and visions for a cooperative society where everyone can have a proper quality of life. To find out more information, please call 1-800-691-6888. That number once again is 1-800-691-6888. Or visit us on the web at www.ptradio.org. I'm Kenny Shook. Thanks for listening in, and please join us next time for People's Tribune Radio.